everyone. We're back today with another episode of Gladio for Europe. I'm Russian Sam, and I'm joined today by my lovely co-hosts. Hello, Sam.
Hello.
And Liam.
How we doing?
And today, we're coming home. We're going back to America, to the hallowed age of the 1960s when everything was perfect. And we're going to be talking about this fascinating 1964 movie called 7 Days of May. It's based on a novel of the same name that was written in 1962 by a pair of guys named Fletcher Neville and Charles Bailey II.
And we should mention that the screenplay was written by Rod Serling, who probably you all know from The Twilight Zone. And in addition, it was directed by John Frankenheimer, who's probably best known for directing a movie called The Manchurian Candidate, which, as we're about to find out, has some interesting similarities to this one. Both of them really tapping into the zeitgeist of this time.
Oh, absolutely. So Frankenheimer considered The Manchurian Candidate, 7 Days of May, and the third movie called Seconds, released in 1966, to be his paranoia trilogy, which is exactly what it sounds like.
The idea of paranoia really kind of getting at a big part of this episode, about not knowing who you can trust, not knowing who your enemies are, which in this period, when this movie came out, the early 1960s, was a really strong current in American society.
Absolutely.
So the movie, it's set in the near future. A president named Jordan Lyman signs a disarmament treaty with the USSR, which is this huge deal, choosing basically to stand down in the Cold War. But of course, this is immediately really controversial, and you have a guy named General Scott, played by Burt Lancaster, who starts to express his disagreement. And across this movie, another smaller military guy, Colonel Casey, Jiggs Casey, played by Kirk Douglas, starts to realize that Scott is planning a coup. And he starts to race against the clock before they can pull off this coup in 7 Days of May. It was cool. It's a pretty sober look at what a coup in the United States would look like. It's not very flashy. Instead, it's a lot of kind of secret backroom dealings between members of the military. The characters were pretty fun. Although none of the performances were, like, really incredible, and some moments were kind of hokey, it was just, it's a cool mystery, and it's cool to see how they unravel it. And I'm a big fan of the Cajun guy, the alcoholic aide, who makes a few appearances.
Oh, that guy's great. When he starts talking about how, if we've had this economy going for 20 years on just total war, you can't just turn that around in a day. Very subtle.
Yeah, very subtle.
Yeah, these were the good old days when we still had white ethnic stereotypes in movies.
Sir, I advise you not to take a ride in an open-top convertible.
I definitely enjoyed it, although it's definitely not a movie that would be made today, per se, because it's very dialogue-heavy. It requires a lot of attention because the plot is a bit convoluted. And I mean that in a positive sense, just like we don't have the attention span today to like actually sit through the full 2 hours of this movie.
I hate to say it, but I understand the appeal of the walk and talk and why it's used so often in television.
No, as a political thriller, it definitely does have, Aaron Sorkin hints. Something else that I think wouldn't fly today, which I found very amusing, was that I don't believe a single woman speaks in this movie until like the 20-minute mark.
Yeah, there are a total of 2 woman characters in this movie.
Yeah. And the main woman character is this like drunken floozy her only function in the movie is to seduce and be seduced.
And she says as much.
Yeah, this was before the Bechdel test was enforced by the Ministry of Wokeness. So obviously we've come a long way since then.
Before we get into this movie in detail, we'd like to get a little bit into the political context of this time. And we all did a little bit of reading for this, and I'd like Liam to lead us off for that.
Sure, yeah. So the main book I read for this was this book called Before the Storm by Rick Perlstein. If anyone's not familiar, Rick Perlstein is just like this incredible historian of the modern right. And that every 5 years, he puts out another like massive, incredibly well-sourced book about the Republican Party and the rise of American conservatives. This one, which is called, like I said, Before the Storm, focuses mostly on Barry Goldwater, who is the golden boy of conservatism in the mid-60s, as well as the John Birch Society, which is this crazy far-right conspiratorial group that's going to take up a lot of the discussion in this episode. One really interesting argument that he makes in Before the Storm is that until the 50s and 60s, there really was not a self-consciously identified conservative movement in the country. And as soon as it took off, it basically gripped America by storm, instilling within the general public this deep reactionary paranoia of the outside world, of communism, and of potential subversives within our ranks.
Exactly. And the idea of communism and communist infiltration at home was just this defining fear, especially for members of the John Birch Society.
And, you know, I think an important part of the story we should mention is that it wasn't so much that the Soviets were so, you know, aggressive in the way that the Americans saw it. It was that the Truman administration basically refused to coexist peacefully with the Soviets.
Stalin offered German reunification and a neutral Germany and he gave up the Greek communists. Like, there were plenty of sacrifices made.
No, absolutely. Stalin totally hung a lot of communists out to dry because he wanted to appease the West.
Yeah, he thought that there could be a deal here, that the people on the other side of the table were rational actors and could make a deal with them.
Yeah, but no. Well, Russian Sam, what did Truman do instead?
In 1947, Truman passed the so-called Loyalty Order, which was an executive order. Like, he passed it in March 1947, right after the Republicans had done very well in the midterm elections. And he basically did this to outflank them, to show them that he's also serious about combating the communist threat. So what the Loyalty Order did is it gave the FBI jurisdiction to screen federal employees for quote-unquote disloyalty, which could range the gamut from espionage or actively calling for the overthrow of the United States government, all the way to being part of an organization that was on the Attorney General's list of subversive organizations, which included things as disparate as the Ku Klux Klan and various Communist Front organizations. And this list of subversive organizations, it wasn't repealed until 1974.
Yeah, which is crazy. Well, yeah, and then so you can see that there's this increased scrutiny across American society of groups that essentially don't belong. Although it sometimes did, like you said, target right-wingers, it really was mostly aimed at anyone agitating for left-wing social change, which included any kind of early civil rights activists, as well as any kind of labor or even intellectual left-wing academic types were under scrutiny.
Yeah, this is also when we started to see the purging of communists and socialists from the labor movement, which would have some devastating effects.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
In 1950, you had this report called NSC 68, which is like a National Security Council document, which was commissioned by the Truman administration to assess the different military capacities of both the United States and Europe, and also industrial strategy. And basically, NSC 68 would go on to provide a blueprint for demilitarization of the Cold War, like all the way from 1950 until arguably until today. So maybe we were a little unfair to Truman earlier. Granted, he was kind of weaselly with this loyalty order thing, but ultimately, he seems to have had good general instincts when it came to domestic policy. He wasn't really a foreign policy guy. Originally, Truman wanted to continue in the legacy of FDR. He wanted to expand these programs that FDR had founded with something that he called the Fair Deal. And he wanted to do this without either raising taxes or running a deficit. And of course, since the war was now over, the military budget seems like an obvious place to make some cuts.
Right. But of course, that isn't going to make everyone happy. There's a lot of people who get very unhappy about the thought of military budget cuts.
Yeah, so this is where an NSC 68 comes into play. It's very much a jack-of-all-trade document. It has a little bit to say about everything. It talks about the industrial and military capacities of both the U.S. and the Soviet Union. But really, the central point was that the United States needed to triple its defense budget.
And how are they going to pay for it?
By running a deficit.
Yeah, so it's kind of, in a way, yeah, it's the beginning of the kind of, like, it's kind of funny because this was basically a right-wing initiative, was to basically increase the military budget to beat the Soviets. But in doing so, they sort of created the major national debt that we have now, which has been this massive right-wing bugbear for the last 60 years.
Albeit one that's focused on, like, that doesn't really address military spending when they talk about it.
No, not at all. That's true.
Yeah, and so this document, and one of the topics it spoke about was quote-unquote Soviet strategy and why it was necessary to pursue a policy of active rollback, i.e. actively combating communism by any means necessary, versus détente, which is something that had been called for by people like George Kennan a couple of years before that.
The fundamental design of those who control the Soviet Union and the international communist movement is to retain and solidify their absolute power. In the minds of the Soviet leaders, Achievement of this design requires the dynamic extension of their authority and the ultimate elimination of any effective opposition to their authority. The design, therefore, calls for the complete subversion or forcible destruction of the machinery of government and structure of society in the countries of the non-Soviet world and their replacement by an apparatus and structure subservient to and controlled from the Kremlin. The United States, as the bulwark of opposition to Soviet expansion, is the principal enemy whose integrity and vitality must be subverted or destroyed by one means or another if the Kremlin is to achieve its fundamental design.
And let me just jump onto that there. I think a really important word is integrity, because what that word means essentially from the perspective of the Truman administration is that any potential display of disunity within the U.S. could potentially be either an opening for the Soviets to break in and exploit disunity, or, you know, divide and conquer, or even could be proof of existing Soviet infiltration. And this is why, in this period, any kind of dissidence with the status quo was seen with incredible scrutiny. And this is why, like we talked about, left-wing intellectuals coming under fire, left-wing union organizers being purged from their unions. There was this massive fear that if anyone isn't happy with the current state of Americans, they may be either a Soviet agent or a useful idiot, allowing the Soviets to subvert and take over this country.
Yeah, the idea of the civil rights movement as a communist plot or a Soviet plot was fairly mainstream to a lot of conservatives at this point.
Well, so I guess, so you think that initially Truman was not exactly comfortable with the implications of this report?
Like I said, Truman was primarily a domestic policy guy. He wanted to pursue a robust domestic agenda.
More in the line of Roosevelt, who, of course, you know, the New Deal.
So when this report was delivered to his desk in 1950, he was very uncomfortable with the implications of it. So what the authors of this report did is they went to the press and gave strategic leaks, making the same arguments that were presented in the report to put pressure on the Truman administration to force them to expand the military budget. And of course, there were very powerful industrial interests standing behind this. And this is massive amounts of money, a tripling of the military budget. There was a lot of money to be made here. But then suddenly, while Truman was still mulling this over, the Korean War began on July 25th. And at this point, it became unavoidable that NSC 68 would become the official policy of the United States. And there are some interesting theories about the Korean War.
The idea that it was the fault of the communists who went mad and just had to cross the line is questionable. And Truman had some pretty major conflicts with General MacArthur, which led to Truman firing MacArthur's ass.
Right. And I think that that's very interesting, because that just has, you know, some interesting interesting parallels to what we're going to be discussing with this movie, 7 Days of May. The leaks you mentioned by the press definitely sort of contributed to this kind of broader public anti-communism and public paranoia about the Cold War. And I think that America's essential, basically, loss in Korea, the U.S.'s inability to oust communists from North Korea, I think was also part of that. There was this fear that communism was this unstoppable threat. And not only were they taking over governments in Asia and Europe, there was also a fear of communists at home.
We forgot to mention there, Liam, the fall of China.
Oh, yeah, that's probably the biggest one of all. You're right.
The biggest one, yeah. Well, the Chinese Nationalist Government and the Kuomintang Party lost the Chinese Civil War because they, for a lot of reasons, but they did not do a good job of governing, and they lost, and they got their asses handed to them, and they fled across the straits of Taiwan, across the strait to Taiwan, and Mao proclaimed the People's Republic, and that freaked people the fuck out in the capitalist world.
Right, and this, yeah, and so the question of who lost China became this major question within American domestic politics. A lot of right-wingers in both the Democratic and Republican parties were furious and horrified at this loss. And interestingly, some right-wingers even thought that the U.S. had an obligation to go back to China and invade, to oust the communists and to bring, you know, Chiang Kai-shek back into power.
Such as General MacArthur, who actually wanted to nuke Beijing during the Korean War.
He did, yeah. And I think that we should mention that in this early nuclear period, the 50s and 60s, even though there was an anti-nuclear movement, there was in general less of a squeamishness about nuclear weapons. And it does seem like on a few occasions, the U.S. might have dropped the bomb again.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, there were a lot of, especially before the Soviets got the bomb as well, there was a feeling of, well, why can't we just do this again? It worked last time.
Yeah. Well, you know, now while we're talking about, you know, right-wingers at home freaking out about and getting paranoid, there were two things that happened that might have been genuine justifications for this paranoia. These were two big news stories which had major implications in the early 50s and then in the early 60s on this kind of right-wing fear of communism. The first one was the identification of a Soviet spy in the U.S. named Alger Hiss, and the second one was a British spy named Kim Philby. Alger Hiss was this American diplomat who was part of the Yalta Conference at the end of World War II and was also part of the Dumbarton Oaks Conference, which basically established the U.N. And even though he was pretty anti-Soviet in his policymaking, like, for instance, he was a big opponent of the idea that the various republics within the Soviet Union, such as Belarus and Ukraine, should get UN votes, it turned out in 1948 that he had actually been a Soviet spy this whole time. You guys are familiar with HUAC?
House Un-American Activities Committee.
That's right. So that group, which was formed, I believe, in the lead-up to World War II, as soon as World War II ended, it became this House anti-communist front, essentially. And HUAC led an organization in concert with a former communist named Whitaker Chambers, who outed Alger Hiss as a spy. And most famously, when HUAC led an investigation to search Alger Hiss's house in Maryland, they found a pumpkin patch. And inside the pumpkins, which had been hollowed out, were all of these military documents that had been stashed there.
Awesome.
Incredibly cool.
And then you also have the case of Kim Philby. He was British, but he was born in India and raised in Saudi Arabia by a guy,
St. John Philby, great name.
St. John Philby, who was a truly, if you want to go down a Wikipedia rabbit hole, just look into his page. He was a big devotee of Ibn Saud.
Yeah. So Kim Philby was raised in Saudi Arabia and with this very elite kind of British colonial family.
Yeah, a very elite British colonial family. And then it turned out that he, an MI6 agent, by the way, was a double agent for the Soviets and passed over 900 top secret documents to Moscow.
Yeah, before World War II, he married a communist woman in Austria who kept her communism hidden. And secretly, she basically, you know, converted him. This like well-bred, fancy boy, she made him a communist. Once he became part of MI6, he made contact with the Soviets and very quickly created this circle within the highest ranks of British intelligence, feeding documents, I believe it was like 900 documents in total, to Moscow. In 1963, over a decade after Alger Hiss was identified, Kim Philby was also revealed. And him and these other four MI6 agents, known as the Cambridge Five, caused this massive scandal across the West and this renewed fear of communist subversion.
And then he lived the rest of his life in Moscow.
Yeah, my favorite thing about Kim Philby is that he was not careful at all. Like, he famously was an alcoholic, and he was constantly dropping hints to his co-workers that he was doing espionage, and he just seemed to cruise by on the fact that he's from this renowned family, and he's a Cambridge boy, so no one really thought much about it.
And I think that the fact that he was from this well-bred family is really important, because both Alger Hiss and Kim Philby were these, like, fancy boys. They both went to fancy prep schools. They were from very well-off parents. And this actually led to this kind of connection by right-wingers of the educated elite with communism. So there was this mass fear in the American middle classes that the people more powerful than them were not actually just regular rich people. They were actually secret communists. And across the 60s, the 50s and 60s, you saw this, the beginning of this kind of populist, anti-elite fear that the people on top were actually Soviets working in concert with the people on the bottom.
I'm just very glad that there aren't any modern day parallels to this.
Yeah. Thankfully, right-wing paranoia like that doesn't exist today.
Attorney General Robert Kennedy told a 1961 press conference, quote, "Communist espionage here in this country is more active than it has ever been. Army recruits saw films like Red Nightmare, narrated by Jack Webb, which depicted an ersatz American town deep within the Soviet interior, where spies were supposedly training in indigenous American arts like sipping sodas at drugstore fountains in order to infiltrate the United States. You could no less avoid breathing in a bit of paranoia in Cold War America, in fact, than you could soot in Charles Dickens' Manchester."
Communist espionage here in this country is more active than ever before.
Yeah, so again, this was very much a bipartisan venture. It had support among both Republicans and Democrats. more liberal Democrats would try to outflank their opponents from the right.
As JFK himself was against Richard Nixon.
Yeah, and like we said, yeah, this kind of paranoia was everywhere. Frankenheimer, the director of this film, 7 Days of May, also directed The Manchurian Candidate, which was proposed that a man running for president had actually been brainwashed by Chinese communists. Another book that's a lot more fun, which is one of my favorites actually, that kind of pokes fun at the paranoia of this time, is The Crying of Lot 49, one of the earliest novels by Thomas Pynchon that really goes into the general fears that everyday people in suburban California had about who was really in power. Could there be forces either on the right or on the left more powerful and too secret for us to understand?
So in 1961, as Eisenhower's term was finally ending, he gave this speech, the only Eisenhower speech that anyone at this point knows anymore, his speech about the military-industrial complex. And he warned everyone about the fact that we are spending, our army budget is more than the income of all corporations. You know, the total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We must guard against the influence, whether sought or unsought, blah, 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 blah. You know the whole story. After spending all these years allowing and participating in the buildup of the military and the military-industrial complex, at the end, out the door, he's like, hey, you guys might want to watch out for that. Sorry.
And not just the actual military, Eisenhower was also a very active coup fomenter. Like, just off the top of my head, there was Iran, there was Guatemala, there was Syria, Indonesia.
Guatemala and Iran are the first, the CIA really cut its teeth there.
Yeah, and I think so we should just say here, what this all goes to show is that this was a time of increased militarism and of increased paranoia. It's the end of the 50s, beginning of the 60s. The Cold War is really in some ways ramping up. There was kind of some hope for detente at certain points in the 50s, but then every so often a new crisis would emerge. And like, for instance, 56 in Hungary, or there was at one point a crisis about West Berlin, and there was a fear that West Berlin was going to be taken over by the rest of Berlin.
The Berlin Airlift.
Yeah, yeah. So all this stuff was happening across the 50s.
And the Cuban Revolution.
And during the same time, a new movement was being formed in the U.S., a movement that didn't get a lot of press at the time, but it's a movement that Perlstein, who's our main source for this episode, insists was actually the biggest, or at least most impactful, social movement of the 60s. And that movement was the conservatives.
So before the 60s, there was really no self-conscious conservative movement in America, not at least in the terms we think about it. Politics was mostly organized along lines of class and ethnicity, more so than like ideology in that.
Yeah, and so to give a really brief overview of what politics looked like before the conservative movement totally transformed things, the Republicans were basically just the middle-class white people's party. If you lived in Ohio, you were not a factory worker, you were a shopkeeper, you would be a Republican. You would also be a Republican if you were a black person in the South, because in the South, where Jim Crow was this totalitarian regime, there was still this association of the Republicans with, you know, the party of Lincoln. But in the North, especially in the Northeast, if you were a worker, if you were an immigrant, you were a Democrat, which meant that the Democrats were this really crazy coalition of, like, you know, urban Catholic and Jewish workers, and then also some kind of educated FDR-type progressives, along with really virulent Southern racists, the neo-Confederates who never left the Democratic Party after the Civil War. So you had this really crazy system that was not based on ideology, where you had left-wingers and right-wingers in both parties. And what happened in the 50s and 60s was a group of people who were opposed to the New Deal, these former anti-FDR conservatives, who a lot of them actually had even opposed getting into World War II because they sort of, you know, sympathized with the fascists. These people in the 50s, they realized maybe they could make common cause with right-wing Democrats in the South and start a new party system.
And they succeeded.
In the 1950s, the Republican Party was largely led by the basically wealthy coastal elites. And these were generally liberal Republicans.
Well, and Midwestern elites, we should add. It was like it was people in New England, people not in cities, but people who might have been in the Midwest, who often were wealthy.
Exactly. And if you were like a hardcore, if you were someone who was very angry about the New Deal or whatever, you didn't really have anyone to go to because Eisenhower was made a compromise with the New Deal and the Rockefellers were okay with that.
Yeah, some of our listeners might be familiar with the phrase Rockefeller Republican, which basically meant right-wing economically, but moderate socially. And those guys were in the driver's seat of the Republican Party throughout the 50s and most of the 60s.
And Rockefeller himself wasn't that right wing on economics. Like as governor of New York State, he expanded a lot of programs.
And the fact that Rockefeller, who had so much influence, was in many ways basically a liberal, infuriated these anti-New Deal right-wingers. And what these guys did, I think the most famous of them was named Mannion. What these guys did was they slowly started funding across the 50s and 60s these local right-wing organizations that together made up what was, for the first time, a movement that was calling itself the conservative movement in America, which I think is really important. The word conservative, which is so fundamental to modern politics, wasn't really a major part of American politics until the 50s and 60s. This was when, for the first time, you saw people across the country, both liberals and Democrats, as in both these anti-New Deal Republicans and these Jim Crow Democrats, identifying themselves as conservatives, not as Southerners, not as Californians, but as conservatives.
And the glue that really bound this new conservative movement together was opposition to the civil rights movement.
Surprise, surprise.
Yes, and we should add, so in the mid-50s, you see the civil rights movement really get kicked into gear with things like the Montgomery bus boycott, and most importantly, the Brown versus Board ruling, which effectively made school segregation illegal. And this just infuriated a lot of white Southern Democrats.
It also made those people really mad at the Supreme Court, which we will come back to later. Basically, what happened was these conservatives realized that they couldn't just say, we do not want black people here. They had to be a little more clever about it.
And especially because these conservatives were all Republicans. And there was still in the Republican Party this understanding that we are the party that Southern black people support. They supported us for a century and a half. We can't abandon them.
Exactly.
So basically what happened was, instead of these conservative Republicans openly aligning themselves with the explicit racism of Southern Democrats, what these Republicans did instead was they came up with the states' rights argument, which where they would say, oh, we support civil rights on paper, but we don't believe the federal government should be telling these states what to do. Famously, when Eisenhower sent federal troops in to ensure the desegregation of schools in Little Rock to protect black students, a lot of conservatives said, we're actually very disappointed that this Republican president is infringing upon the state of Arkansas, because we don't believe that's the federal government's authority. And that alone, that statement by conservatives was enough to get a lot of Southern Democrats, who for a century had despised the Republican Party because of the Civil War, to suddenly start thinking, maybe these conservatives are actually on our side.
Exactly.
Yeah, so this conservative movement, it first coalesced around Nixon in 1960 when he was running against Kennedy, and then even more prominently in 1964 around Barry Goldwater in opposition to Nelson Rockefeller, who again was one of those old school liberal Republicans.
Yeah, and there was this major split in the Republican Party between the Rockefeller Republicans and the conservatives. And the thing that Perlstein notes is that at the time, because Goldwater ended up getting the nomination in 64 and losing really badly to Johnson, because it wasn't that long after the Kennedy assassination, Americans didn't really want to immediately jump onto the Republicans, especially such a conservative Republican, that after 64, you had a lot of people in the U.S. convincing themselves that conservatism was a failed movement. But then just 4 years later, Nixon, who had now aligned himself with the former Goldwater supporters with this conservative movement, won the White House, and the conservatives were in charge of the country. And one of these conservatives that was the most significant intellectually in terms of his lasting legacy was this one Goldwater supporter who was a bit more moderate than some of them, or at least more respectable, a more of a buttoned-up conservative, William F. Buckley.
William F. Buckley. Kind of an American approximation of like a British boarding school toff, you know, aristocratic Tory kind of thing. Kind of the American approximation of that. Or at least that's what he was trying to do to a large degree. He spoke in this annoying transatlantic accent. You know, the one I'm thinking of?
Yeah, he's like the traditional WASP stereotype, except he was actually Catholic.
Exactly. But he founded this Intercollegiate Society of Individualists, a right-wing student organization. And more importantly, he founded the National Review.
Right. I think what we should note right now, which is kind of important, is that these right-wing intellectual groups had never really existed before. They were occupying a space that had previously been the domain of the left. The idea of intellectual political advocacy. And because of that, people like Buckley and a few other figures we're going to mention explicitly modeled themselves in their tactics after the left.
Exactly. The National Review was like the first self-consciously conservative newspaper in the U.S. It was the beginning of right-wing media, which is pretty insane to think about. Like, we had partisan media. We had newspapers that supported political parties or political candidates. That's always been a thing. But this was an explicitly ideological conservative publication, which was really the first thing we'd had and was honestly closest to the kind of the Marxist weeklies we had in the 30s.
Yeah, that's the best analog. And what's interesting is that, as Perlstein notes, a lot of the people involved in the conservative movement at this time were actually former communists themselves.
So there was this one fellow by the name of Marvin Liebman.
Oh, you think he's a New Yorker, Marvin Liebman?
As a high school student, became a member of the Communist Party. It was the spirit of the times. It was just what you did back in those days. He joined the army during World War II, but he got a dishonorable discharge for his romantic inclinations, shall we put it.
Romance of the Communist Party and also other men. So Martin Liebman, who's this guy, who's a closeted gay man, interestingly, he, this communist, moved to Greenwich Village in this kind of New York intellectual circle, but he ended up sort of drifting away from communism and getting involved in a different social movement with a little bit of overlap, which was Zionist advocacy for the early state of Israel. So he became involved in raising money for Israel, you know, and he apparently was pretty good at it because he raised a lot of money. And this here, he kind of cut his teeth on the idea of political organizing and fundraising, which would become his career for the rest of his life.
So as we've been told it, he had met a Russian defector who had been a prisoner in the gulags. And at this point, he came to face with the idea that, like, his communist vision did not correspond to the reality of the Soviet Union. And from that point onwards, he became a fervent anti-communist.
Yeah, if I could quote Perlstein here, Perlstein writes, "The experience was a common one among former communist leaders on the right. When they realized that the side they thought was the banner of light was really the embodiment of evil, communists became anti-communist warriors, no less convinced of the stakes of this conflict, no less fervent, and no less driven. But what made this anti-communist warrior unique was that he had received the best public relations education money couldn't buy. His masterpiece was the Committee of 1 Million, which had supposedly collected 1 million signatures to keep Red China out of the UN.
Which it was out of the UN until the fucking 70s.
These right-wingers were already influencing policy and were already, this was in the early mid-50s, very concerned with communist infiltration, especially in regards to China. China was a pet project for a really long time of this conservative movement because they really felt this whole, not really a guilt, but a shame over the idea of the loss of China.
And the idea that specifically that was America's fault, that China was quote-unquote lost.
One other right-winger who I chose because I think he's a really good example of the way that the right built itself in the 60s and the 50s in the image of the left, Frederick Clifton White.
F. Clifton White found his calling after the war, entering graduate school to study political science at Cornell and forming a chapter of the American Veterans Committee, a left-wing advocacy group. No leftist himself, he simply wanted to organize to fight the growing Ithaca landlords who were taking advantage of a housing shortage and students rich with GI Bill cash.
Right. And what's kind of interesting is that this was in the 40s, where when there still was active communist organizing in the U.S. The scrutiny we talked about before hadn't really gotten to full swing, so there were substantial Communist Party chapters, and Frederick Clifton White, he ended up encountering real communists who ran against him and beat him in an election within this group. There were some students who were veterans who were communists beat him.
White learned that the communists organized as cells, small face-to-face groups under the discipline of a single benign dictator, chosen for willingness to act and as an extension of the party's will.
Yeah, and what's kind of funny is that the way he did this was the way he disciplined his own group, his more right-wing members of the student group, was he made them follow Robert's Rules of Order. And if anyone's ever been to a DSA meeting, you can see how this is like a classic text for like running a meeting and running a political organization.
Side note, this isn't the only example you see of the right adopting some left-wing models of organization. Like, the Kuomintangs, at least I believe, was a Democratic Centralist Party for quite a while. Hell, the Kuomintang Army had political officers.
In 1961, you had this rather infamous incident where a general by the name of Edwin Walker, basically he had been exposed for teaching his regiment of 10,000 troops a very heavily anti-communist, paranoid curriculum, which resulted in him getting sacked from the military and This created a massive uproar in American conservative circles because there was this impression that liberals were going after an American general for being anti-communist.
And this was a really early kind of cause celeb for the conservative movement. They saw this popular conservative figure, Edwin Walker, being, as they saw it, you know, like crucified by like who, as they saw these communist patsies. And then increasingly, more fringe members of the conservative movement started to wonder that if the people they saw as patsies, both Republicans and Democrats, were, you know, impugning the credibility of this wonderful anti-communist, is it possible that these Republicans, Democrats were themselves secret communists? All right, well, you know what? Okay, it's been long enough. Let's just very briefly talk about the plot of this movie. Halal Sam, tell us just really briefly about the context that this movie came out in.
So it was released in 1964 after the Kennedy assassination, that was supposed to come earlier, but it was delayed because of that. But it was based on a novel written in 1962, which was just before the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the authors, Neble and Bailey, were closely connected to the Kennedy campaign and later the administration. The concerns in the novel are pretty representative of what the Kennedy administration was concerned about. And that's because it was being written as the Bay of Pigs invasion was happening. And Kennedy himself was actually a pretty big fan of the book. He supposedly told a friend that he thought the events of the book were plausible if another failure in the level of Bay of Pigs happened. And he made jokes about it and that he knew some generals who'd love to do it.
Yeah. And well, so the book comes out, and then really soon after, Kirk Douglas, who was one of the biggest, you know, progressive liberals in Hollywood, purchased the rights to it. Just first, a little side note, Kirk Douglas, around this time also, he was involved. He was the big force behind the movie Spartacus, which was a very kind of interesting sort of a rallying cry for the left, because it was a movie that involved the participation of a lot of blacklisted communist writers and film people. And also it was a story that, you know, socialists had always celebrated, this idea of this Roman slave leading this failed campaign against the empire. And tying this back to the Kennedy administration, there was the opening scene is a protest that we're about to talk about between supporters of the president who has recently signed an anti-nuclear treaty and supporters of the right-wing pro-nuclear General Scott. And what's kind of interesting is that when they were filming that scene outside of the White House, there actually was a real anti-nuclear protest happening that day. And the film crew cleared out the real protest so they could stage the fake one. And, you know, I think one last thing, just to give a little bit of context about the ways that the bomb was being discussed by conservatives. Goldwater, who is not a great parallel for General Scott, but does represent kind of the attitude of this character, the kind of right-wing pro-nuclear attitude. What did he say in his memoirs about nuclear bombs?
Goldwater wrote that, quote, "It is worth noting that the public's almost hysterical, unreasoned attitude towards nuclear war was fattened on the misrepresentations of three works of fiction, On the Beach, Failsafe, and 7 Days in May."
What the fuck is a reasoned attitude towards nuclear war?
That we shouldn't have it, maybe?
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about the movie itself. So like we said, there's Lyman, this kind of liberal president, and then his opponent is this guy, General Scott, played by Burt Lancaster. Kirk Douglas, playing a young officer, realizes that actually something's going on here. There's something up within the Pentagon that doesn't seem right. He meets with a friend named Mudd, great name, and learns that there's a secret group within the military called EconCom, I believe, and that he starts to realize that this group, EconCom, that his friend is working in, is actually plotting the overthrow of President Lyman. Across the movie, you know, President Lyman sends advisors to investigate. One of them is that Cajun guy we mentioned before. And they realize, yeah, it's true that the Joint Chiefs of Staff are involved in this conspiracy. And it's a lot of kind of like intricate, you know, twists and turns. There's one scene which is a little kind of weird, kind of sexist, I feel like, where Kirk Douglas finds Burt Lancaster's mistress and seduces her to gain some documents. And then, but eventually they have enough evidence to prove that Burt Lancaster really is trying to overthrow President Lyman. And there's this kind of climactic confrontation where Lyman uses basically facts and logic to convince him that the coup isn't worth it. And that if they really do overthrow the government, then the Soviet Union will see it as a sign of weakness, a sign of disunity. There's that disunity again. And use that as an excuse to attack.
Yeah, so in a word, this movie is basically Mr. Smith goes to Washington, except there's a military coup involved.
Yeah, definitely. One other thing that I found kind of interesting is that when Scott, played by Burt Lancaster, is saying why he opposes denuclearization. He says something akin to, basically it's the same argument that we heard in the lead up to the war in Iraq.
We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud.
Exactly. That if the U.S. lays down their arms, we're the guy who plays chicken. And the Soviets, we can't trust them to do it. As soon as we disarm, they're going to nuke us. Which, I guess, is probably how a lot of right-wingers thought. That even though these fears, we know through hindsight, were completely overblown, a lot of right-wingers really did think they were living on the brink of a communist takeover. They saw things happening, like we talked about in China in 49. They saw the Soviets cracked on and their Hungarian allies in 56. And there was this brewing fear of global communism. Now, here's a question for all you guys. So tell me about the people that you find comparable to General Scott, who is really the antagonist of this movie, the coup plotter.
Obviously, MacArthur is the most obvious parallel to General Scott. This kind of like bombastic, warmongering, nuke-happy, rabid anti-communist.
If you know nothing about MacArthur, the way that I would describe him is that Trump is a supermarket brand version of MacArthur.
Yeah, just imagine if Trump went to West Point.
Didn't he want to use nuclear bombs against China during the Korean War?
I remember reading at one point that he had a proposal to turn the Korean Sino-Korean border into just a uninhabitable zone by just dropping nukes all over the border so that the PLA couldn't pass through.
To be honest, it's not that much different from what we actually did to the Korean border. Yeah, the other figure that I think is a really good parallel for Scott, who probably was a bit of an inspiration, maybe more so than MacArthur, is the aforementioned Edwin Walker, who was a general in World War II in Korea, who initially was a sort of an ally of Eisenhower because he was one of the people involved in the integration of Little Rock. But then he actually became a conservative hero by speaking out against his role in the integration.
Yeah, like, again, he was one of those anti-civil rights guys on principle. He said that he supported integration in principle, but he thinks that it should be a matter of people voluntarily.
Right, right. And which I would characterize as kind of the reemergence of the kind of states' rights apologia of the 1860s and 1850s, when people said that, I'm not pro-slavery in principle, a lot of Southerners insisted, but, you know, like, the federal government has no right to end slavery.
No, but the federal government does have the right to promote slavery.
Yeah, that's what they believe, of course, because look, no matter what the era is, right-wingers are always going to be, you know, a bunch of hypocritical pieces of shit.
Yeah, so Walker was going around and causing a bit of trouble for the Eisenhower administration to the point where they just decided that, well, first he tried to resign, but they didn't let him do it, and they just transferred him over to Germany in Augsburg, where he was put in charge of 10,000 troops, and he began what he called a quote-unquote pro-blue anti-communist program, which included a lot of John Birch Society material.
So this is really interesting. This is a really cool missing link between, that really connects this movie, 7 Days in May, with the paranoid context it existed in. Because this figure, who it really seems like is the direct model for General Scott, the antagonist of this movie, he was very closely tied with the John Birch Society, which was this popular right-wing, arguably quasi-fascist group trying to resist supposed communist infiltration in the U.S. It was led by a guy we're going to talk about shortly named Robert Welch, who personally knew General Walker. And together, they basically agreed that they should disseminate right-wing conspiratorial material within the military because they believed there was communist infiltration happening within the U.S. Army itself.
Yeah, so let's go back to General Walker himself. So it began to be reported in April 1961 that he was doing this as well as giving speeches where basically he calls Eleanor Roosevelt and Eisenhower a bunch of pinkos.
Yet noted communist Eisenhower.
And this freaked a lot of people out back home. He was immediately relieved of command, and he chose to resign in November. And the reason why people were freaking out so much is because this event actually happened at the same time as the attempted coup attempt of President Charles de Gaulle of France in April 1961.
Which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, a bunch of generals were very unhappy with de Gaulle's conduct in Algeria, and they wanted it to remain an integral part of France, and so they tried to overthrow him.
It also wasn't the first time they tried.
Well, yeah, but still, this was kind of a big deal.
It's that globally there was kind of this brewing right-wing resentment, and it was a resentment that was infringing upon the liberal order.
I think it's really important to hammer home the quote-unquote loss of China as, like, a central point to these people's neurosis.
Yes. And you know what? We could even complain. We could compare the literal loss of Algeria to the French Empire to the supposed loss of China to American right wingers.
Oh, for sure.
That the country with the largest population in the world has suddenly become communist. How did we let this happen? And a lot of these right wingers really did seem to think that they were losing the Cold War, which really seems laughable in hindsight, given what we know about how the Cold War ended. But these guys seem to think that if both Russia and China are communist, who's next? Which domino is going to fall next? And what these guys believed, these conservatives, was that they needed to step up fast to stop communists from taking over the rest of the world. And the John Birch Society believed they had to start by getting rid of the communists here in America. Just like that guy Kim Philby, the Soviet defector in the UK we mentioned earlier, this guy John Birch was born in India to basically, you know, colonial parents. His parents were American missionaries trying to spread Protestant Christianity into the Indian population, and he really spent much of his life across Asia. In World War II, he was an intelligence agent in the OSS, you know, which was the forerunner to the CIA. And in 1945, he was actually sent on a mission to Qingdao, you know, where the beer comes from, to liberate an Allied POW camp. And I'll just say, by the end of the mission, John Birch would be killed. And his death in China sparked a whole wave of conspiracies. Most important among them was a conspiracy formulated by the John Birch Society that we mentioned earlier. But before we talk about how crazy the John Birch Society was and why they came about, I want to talk about who this guy John Birch actually was and what we know about how he actually died.
So the version that the American and Kuomintang, Chinese nationalist version of the story, basically is this. So they were traveling from Lijiang and they saw some communist soldiers tearing up railway tracks and cutting down telephone and telegraph poles. This really made Birch mad, but General Beng and Lieutenant Dong told him that the situation was dangerous and he shouldn't mess with this. But supposedly he scorned them, saying, "Never mind, I want to see how the communists treat Americans. I don't mind if they kill me, for America will then stop the communist movement with atomic bombs."
Right, so these, according to the Chinese nationalist allies of John Birch, he was, at least it seems like in this moment, a little bit of a loose cannon.
Yeah, which, that is an insane thing to say. Don't worry, they'll stop the communist movement with atomic bombs.
Yeah, he seems to have had a bad case of PTSD. He was fighting in China for almost 4 years at that point, and he was behind enemy lines a lot. Genuinely a heroic figure in many ways and very brave, but clearly had a few screws loose by this time.
Yeah, he'd seen some shit. So then about 300 soldiers from the PLA's 8th Red Army surrounded the OSS party, and Birch and Dong went ahead to speak with their commanding officer.
So these are the communists that they ran into. They ran into a group of communists while they were in China.
About 300 soldiers from the CCP's 8th Red Army surround the OSS party, and Birch and Dong went ahead to speak with the commanding officer. And Birch identified himself and explained his mission, but he refused to be disarmed and would not allow the communists to examine or take his team's equipment.
Right, which eventually would be his fatal flaw, that he refused to let the communist take his weapon that he had with him.
Yeah, in this story, what happened next was the Red Army commander did not insist on holding or delaying them. He informed Birch that the next railway station to the east was now in the hands of the communist troops and said Dong should go ahead of the others and explain why the OSS team was in the area.
Right, and so they get to Huangco, and the same thing happens again. Basically, they say that he has to give their weapons. They tell him and his ally Dong that they have to give him their weapons, and just again, John Birch refuses.
Yeah. Birch angrily said to the soldier in Chinese, "At present, the Americans have liberated the whole world, and you want us to stop and disarm us? Are you bandits?" And this was a pretty serious insult, since the nationalists regularly called communists bandits.
So I don't know if Birch was deliberately trying to be provocative, but yeah, so he was like, so this was a time when the communists and the nationalists, I guess they had pretty recently been working together. It was a really tense and uneasy time. And so clearly John Birch is basically fanning the flames here.
On paper, they were still working together. They had just recently formed a coalition government, actually, which fell apart very quickly. But
yeah, and honestly, and I wouldn't be surprised if this particular incident was no small part in why they fell apart.
An officer wearing a Sam Brown belt cursed and ordered him to load their guns and disarm Birch. "Wait a minute, please," cried Dong. "If you want to disarm him, I will get the gun for you." Don later testified he did this because Captain Birch, quote, would have become violent if any communist tried to disarm him.
Yeah, so clearly this guy was definitely in a very weird state at the day of, on the night of his death. He was definitely not, yeah, not being very rational.
He's not well. But as Deng reached for Birch's weapon, the officer pointed at him and yelled, "Shoot him first." The bullet struck Deng's right thigh a few inches above the knee and he fell down. A second shot was fired and Deng heard Birch say in Chinese, "I'm hit in the leg, I can't walk." He then heard another shot. At that night, they hastily buried Birch and took Deng to a shelter where they placed him on a wooden board. And realized that the death of an American military officer could mean serious trouble, the communist commander had released one of the Chinese from the OSS party. The commander was very sorry for the incident, which he said did not represent the policy of the communists.
Right, so it really seems like, if anything, the death of John Birch was, if anything, a miscommunication. This very stressed American spy who was acting a little too haughty and acting somewhat irrational, and these hostile troops, essentially, that were supposed to be working with him, they didn't trust him, and they killed him. Their take is that Birch and Deng had acted aggressively, and they even pointed their guns at a commander when they were supposed to be disarmed. What the Communist Party claimed is that the soldiers who killed Birch were actually operating in self-defense. And they realized that once these guys were actually Americans, they realized that, oh shit, we made a mistake, and they apologized to the American side. But what's kind of interesting here is that although this was kind of, in some ways, kind of a big deal, you know, this American soldier being killed by communists in China, it was not initially published in 45 when it happened. The Americans actually thought that maybe Birch kind of had it coming. Maybe he was acting too haughty. Maybe he should have been more responsible in this situation. But I think that by not releasing this story in 45, I think the US military might have made a big mistake, because suddenly there was this image of a cover-up.
So his family was told that he was had been killed by stray bullets, which is pretty unbelievable. And it received some coverage in American newspapers, but it faded away very quickly.
It was never shown as like, communist kill an American boy, which was what the narrative soon would be.
No.
This is what the army had taken note of. In fact, the person who had come to the Birch family house to notify them that John was dead, like, he gave them the stray bullets version, but Birch's mother noticed that on his clipboard, it was written that he was killed by communists. And at this point, Ethel Birch, that being his mother, had become obsessed with learning the truth about her son's fate. She needed some form of closure, some measure of justice. Based on her own investigation, she reached the awful conclusion that her son's death was not an accident, as the War Department led us to believe from the official telegram and confirming letter, but a deliberate murder on the part of the Chinese communists.
So basically, because of this grieving mother's efforts, this story did slowly become to be well known, and expectedly and very unfortunately, latched upon by the right.
So John Birch's story was resurrected in 1950, shortly after the beginning of the Korean War, most importantly by Senator William Noland, who was known as the Senator from Formosa.
Yeah, Formosa meaning Taiwan, because of his, you know, strong advocacy for Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalist cause.
That very democratic regime there.
Oh god, yeah.
Now Birch, he became a political football in the whole who lost China debate, which was really taking off, just like really dominating American foreign policy discourse in Washington, because the quote-unquote loss of China, it is the biggest country in the world. It's, you know, right next to the Soviet Union, and if you just look at a map, it's like, oh my god, all of Asia is going communist, and that's what these people believed. So and this also happened to be around the time that relations with the new government in Beijing were worsening. And that's why Newland seized on this and on the fate of John Birch, to show that U.S. policy was misguided. Quote, "If the Secretary of State and the President of the United States have not read the eyewitness accounts of the death of Captain Birch, I think it is unfortunate that it was not called to their attention as soon as it was available in 1945. If they have read it, I do not see how they could have approved the policies we followed in China subsequent to 1945.
Right. So you saw a whole bunch of right-wingers, including members of this nascent conservative movement in the late 40s, early 50s, starting to think, there's something that we're not being told about this China story. Why are we suddenly recognizing, or at least cooperating with, a communist government in the biggest country in the world? And one of these people that really latched on to the John Birch story was a guy named Robert Welch.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, I've seen one person refer to him as a maniacal Willy Wonka, because he was a candy entrepreneur, actually. That's how he made his money.
Yeah, his family, they invented the sugar daddy. So whenever you ever buy sugar daddies, you're supporting, in a sense, the John Birch Society.
And that really is representative of this new strain of American conservatism, the kind of local magnates, the small business tyrants. And
A local rich guy. We should probably mention, creator of a really shitty candy, too.
Really shit? Is it really shit? I've never had one.
Oh, yeah. It's like the worst. Yeah, sugar daddies, they're like the worst candy. Yeah, they're probably the worst candy you ever had.
Damn. Not surprising.
Yeah, so Welch was an interesting figure. In fact, during the Second World War, he had served on the board of the Office of Price Administration and the War Production Board, which, for people who aren't familiar, these were mechanisms by which the Roosevelt administration did rationing during the war.
Which is funny. So even though this guy was incredibly anti-New Deal, he was part of that older generation, the like 1930s Republicans, he was actually working in the Roosevelt administration himself, which is bizarre.
So the war ends, and suddenly he finds that he's actually very interested in politics. And he's very against communism and collectivism more generally. In 1950, he makes an attempt to run for lieutenant governor of Massachusetts, but he didn't really get anywhere. And it was at this point that he realized that there are other ways to get power.
The communists, after all, did not work their domination through electoral politics. They did it by seizing institutions from within. If he recruited enough people to explain the conspiracy, for instance, how the communists bamboozled Americans into believing they lived in a democracy, not a republic, the conspiracy could not work. He figured he'd need about 1 million people to rout the communists altogether.
Right.
If you just use facts and logic and tell enough people about how the Reds have infiltrated everything, then you can beat them.
Yeah, yes. So he sat down and he established the John Birch Society, which would be the bulwark of extreme right-wing anti-communism in the 50s and 60s.
The people who saw communists, like, in the behind the shadows everywhere.
Yeah, so the John Birch Society, Welch finally founded it in 1958 after having been a crank for quite some time. He sent letters to several of his friends for a conference which would take place after the National Association of Manufacturers Congress of Industry, which is, to this day, a very powerful industrial lobbying group.
Yeah, and they really were his core support. So these were, again, like local kind of bourgeois. These were like local but rich guys who owned factories. I know that I think that the Kohler family was involved, in, for instance, in like right-wing causes who make like sinks. And another family you found that also starts with a K.
Fred Koch was one of the people in attendance.
Let's go.
Yeah, and of course, this gets to my own crank theory of the John Birch Society, which is that this was a deliberate effort to sow doubt in the efficacy of government so these corporate interests could instead fill in the void of power which would be left behind.
Maybe so, yeah, that's true, because if you think that the government are actual communists bent on just subverting and destroying America, then you're probably going to be way more in favor of deregulation. Speaking of crank theories, Halal Sam, tell us about one other supporter of Robert Welch at this time.
Ravilo P. Oliver. He was a longtime friend of William F. Buckley. He worked as a book reviewer for the National Review, but he was sacked after writing Marksmanship, M-A-R-X, in Dallas, which honestly, that's a funny title. I'll give him that one.
Yeah, that's actually funny. It's actually an article about how Oswald was actually a part of a much larger Soviet plot.
Which was the standard thinking. I mean, he defected to the Soviet Union and came back. Anyways, he was convinced that Welch was either tricked or sold out to Zionist interests, that he objected to what was called the Birch hoax. He was forced to resign from the society on July 30th in 66, and he later claimed in 1981 to have discovered that Welch, quote, was merely the nominal lead of a Birch business, which he had operated under the supervision of a committee of Jews. We're back on our bullshit, baby. We're back to anti-Semitism.
So it's clear that this group attracted a lot of very awful, typical kind of right-wing cranks. This guy's anti-Semitism is interesting. Even though the Birch Society was not broadly anti-Semitic, I think it does kind of connect to the fact that the main thrust of the John Birch conspiracy theory, the idea that there's an internal enemy subverting us from within, does look a lot like typical anti-Semitism.
It's Elders of Zion shit.
Yeah. It looks a lot like the kind of Nazi-era Judeo-Bolshevism, the idea that like regular Jewish families in Germany are actually part of a worldwide conspiracy to bring Germany under Jewish domination.
Exactly.
And then the end. So in 54, Robert Welch published his first major text, which was The Life of John Birch, basically telling his conspiratorial take on that guy, John Birch, rather than explaining the pretty complicated situation of how he pissed off some communist officers and got himself killed. Robert Welch insisted that actually Birch's death was an assassination covered up by the State Department, who were working with Mao to take over America, and that actually he was about to uncover this global communist conspiracy, and for that, he was killed. I think that an interesting parallel to this that we see in contemporary politics are the conspiracy theories around the death of Seth Rich.
Yes.
I think he was just like 26 years old or something.
Some campaign staffer, yeah.
Yeah, a campaign staffer involved with Hillary, who was tragically murdered in a mugging in, 2016. And instantly, all these right-wingers insisted he was actually killed by Hillary Clinton because he knew too much. He knew whatever, and they had to silence him.
Exactly. No, it's all the same template. These people are not original. I really wish we had more originality in our conservative
today. Oh, I know. Well, you know, we mentioned that Robert Welch got started at this by giving a lecture at the National Association of Manufacturers. One thing I want to add is that his initial lecture lasted 2 days straight, breaking only for meals and sleep, which really shows, I think, how fanatic he was.
Jesus Christ, man.
Read us that quote we found from what he gave at that initial first lecture.
We are living in America today in such a fool's paradise as the people of China lived 20 years ago, as the people of Czechoslovakia lived a dozen years ago, as the people of North Vietnam lived 5 years ago, and as all the people of Iraq lived only yesterday. It was all part of the plan. Elites surrendered American sovereignty to the UN, foreign aid rotting our balance of payments, skyrocketing taxes, unbalanced budgets, inflation. There was only one way to explain it. Our labor unions, churches, schools, governments, all had been infiltrated.
Right. And so clearly it's this incredibly paranoid organization that just sees communists everywhere. And in 61, 3 years after this, he published his big manifesto, which was the Blue Book.
They were just verbatim transcripts of the lectures that he gave in Indianapolis.
Yes, of all of his lectures. And he sought to create this unified theory explaining how all of his various paranoias actually came together in this global communist plot. So if I could just read one little excerpt here, Robert Welch says, Lenin died in 1924, but before he died, he laid out for his followers a plan of world conquest. First, Lenin said, we shall take Eastern Europe. Next, the masses of Asia. Then we shall encircle the last bastion of capitalism, the United States of America. We shall not even have to attack it. Instead, America will fall like overripe fruit into our hands. And then Welch continues, the communists, through long, careful, and insidious preparation, have already gone at least one-fourth of the way toward the accomplishment of their third and final step, which is taking over this country and with it the world.
I love imagining just like a progress bar for the communist takeover.
Yeah. Well, you know, it kind of reminds you of that the famous image of Bibi Netanyahu with his bomb diagram showing that, oh, we believe Iran is 80% of the way, you know, making a bomb.
Oh, that was so good. I miss him so much.
The Blue Book also was, you know, it's kind of funny, but it's also really terrible because some of the stuff he believes is just quite malicious, I think.
The whole slogan of civil rights, as used to make trouble in the South today, is an exact parallel to the slogan of agrarian reform, which they used in China. And the communists, who are pulling innocent and idealistic Americans into promoting this agitation for them, have no real interest in the welfare of the Negroes and no more concern about the damage they actually do to our colored population than the Chinese communists had with regard to the welfare of the Chinese peasants.
He goes beyond states' rights and actually says that he's opposed to the civil rights movement at all because he insists that it is communist subversion.
Yeah, no, this was a very popular line on the American right for a while. There are a lot of people thought Martin Luther King was a communist agent. It's vicious racism.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, yes. And we're going to get into another in a second how the John Birch Society was quite racist.
Oh, extremely racist.
Even if they expunged their explicitly anti-Semitic members like Revilo Oliver, they had very racist beliefs tied up with their anti-communism.
Yeah, so he does have some levity. It's not a work without a sense of humor. So sometimes you get these tangents on these very weird niche topics. One example of this is on the other side of the hemisphere, we have Hawaii. And for the truth about the present communist control of the Hawaiian Islands, just ask any member, Republican or Democrat, of the Senate subcommittee, which spent considerable time on the islands investigating the situation in the fall of 1956.
Yeah, communist Hawaii. Well, I think this just shows that, you know, Robert Welch was looking at the wrong island, you know. He should have been looking at the Caribbean instead.
Yeah, and there were a bunch of other really fun crank beliefs. Like, for example, he insists that the Soviets never actually built nuclear weapons, that, in fact, basically communist agents had stolen from the United States and shipped them to the Soviet Union, who would then assemble them.
And that's a very convenient belief to have, because if the Soviet Union doesn't actually have nuclear weapons, that means the United States can invade the Soviet Union or China without any pushback. And that's really what they wanted. They were really quite interventionist in a lot of ways, and they really believed that the U.S. should be actively invading, essentially, communist countries or doing whatever they could to contain global communism.
Yeah, they wanted us to help. They wanted the U.S. Army to help the nationalists, like, cross the Strait of Taiwan and reinvade the mainland.
Yeah, yes. What's funny is that the U.S. government was working tirelessly to fight communism. The U.S. government was backing some of the most brutal militias ever. The U.S. government was committing terrible atrocities themselves all across the Cold War.
Funding a global network of just terror and drug smuggling.
But for these absolute paranoid psychos in the John Birch Society, that wasn't enough.
Yeah, the fact that the Soviet Union exists is proof.
And the fact that the U.S. was not invading communist countries in the 50s and 60s was proof enough that, therefore, the U.S. was co-opted and controlled by communists.
Well, it actually wasn't quite as simple as that. In fact, Welch was a beautiful mind. He was able to hold many different ideas at once. He seems to have opposed a large percentage of the military spending that we do because he was under the impression that the communists who run our government are creating the false impression that the enemy is external. And in this way, America is squandering its resources, building up its military, its bases abroad.
I think really he was a contrarian. And I think that initially his big push was we must confront communism with military force. And then once that started happening with Vietnam, I think he realized he had to contort himself to explain why he still had to oppose the government, which he believed was communist.
The John Birch Society had some other pretty insane beliefs that we can get into.
Yeah. Every year they had a scoreboard, which is really funny, that shows what percentage communist each country was. I think it's very funny. They loved their numbers. Robert Welch was obsessed with percentages, you know? So, for instance, one year he said that the USA, we believe, is 50 to 60% communist. Iceland, however, is 80 to 100% communist, which I think is very funny, you know? And we should add that at this time, there was a major left-wing reaction to the formation of the John Birch Society that probably colored the depiction of right-wing popular figures in that movie 7 Days of May. And you even saw a lot of comparisons, like in Time magazine, for instance, to the Nazis, which maybe wasn't too far off because these guys were a popular reactionary organization that were quite militarized.
There's a really fun one. They believe that Chinese commandos were training in Mexico for an invasion of the United States through San Diego, and that 100,000 UN troops, 16,000 of them African troops, who are cannibals, were secretly rehearsing in the Georgia swamps under the command of a Russian colonel for the UN martial law takeover of the United States.
Yeah, so just unbelievable psycho paranoia.
Which, side note, we've seen some echoes of that in, like, QAnon today. There was that one thing where they believed that there was going to be an invasion by Chinese PLA troops through Canada.
Yeah, yeah. I think actually specifically, I think they believed that during the whole Stop the Steal thing, when they insisted that Trump actually won the election, they insisted that China tried and failed to invade the U.S. through Canada, which is hilarious. Some American pilot, some poor kid in the Air Force, died in training, and they said, oh, actually, he was shot down by the Chinese, and that he was the only casualty in a failed attempt to invade the U.S.
President Xi, I am a 12-year-old girl who needs high-speed rail. Please, President Xi, please rescue me.
Yeah, speaking of China, because of the whole John Birch Chinese connection, the John Birch Society was always really tied up with Chinese politics, and they demanded massive assistance for the nationalist forces fighting, you know, Red China. So, and they wanted, they basically wanted the U.S. to, like you said, intervene and invade China, cross the straits on behalf of Chiang Kai-shek to reimpose Kuomintang rule in China.
Which is truly insane shit.
They even wanted to invade in Congo, which I find very interesting.
Yes. Oh, in Congo, so there was a civil war between Lumumba and this right-wing secessionist movement run by this guy named Moise Tshumba. I'm probably butchering that. He was in this province called Katanga, which was very resource-rich, and the whole thing was bankrolled by this Belgian mining company called Union Minière, and also with some Belgian military advisors and white mercenaries. And Birch demanded immediate support for Tshumba, even though the UN formally supported Lumumba and even sent troops against Moise Tshumba and the Katanga secessionists. But yeah, this was more evidence for the idea of the UN as a communist organization.
Yes, because the fact that the UN, who the US, of course, the US is a major member, was sending troops to support a government that they believed was communist. Because Lumumba was like a strong social democrat who was, you know, being beset by this right-wing insurrection. Interestingly, actually, we should probably mention that I find kind of funny is that Tshombe, the right winger, was actually going to, you know, give a tour across the U.S. and speak at American conservative events. And interestingly, knowing that this was under Kennedy, knowing that this could cause unrest, they canceled the trip. And the the Kennedy administration really pissed off the Birchers by not letting Tshombe speak. And what I think is funny is that this guy Tshombe, he ultimately won, because what happens a little bit after this, the CIA organizes a coup that involved Lumumba being taken out and assassinated, and Tshombe was put in his place. So even though the Birchers were loudly clamoring for the United States to support this guy Tshombe against Lumumba, the social democratic leader of the Congo, in fact, the U.S. actually was working much more quietly to do exactly what they called for.
Well, he was briefly, he became PM of the DRC for a bit, but he was not immediately after Lumumba. Katanga didn't end up seceding forever, but the European mining companies got what they wanted. Also, they killed Doug Hammarskjöld.
This just shows that, you know, the Birch Society, they were calling everyone a communist, and they called them communists because they weren't willing to fight against communism, when in fact, if you look a little bit closer, the American government was deeply committed to the fight against communism and often did some really terrible things as part of that fight. And I know one thing that's probably most famous, they even called Eisenhower a communist.
Yes, this was kind of, it is at least seen and presented as the like last straw between William F. Buckley and his faction and the Birchers, the accusation of Eisenhower as a communist.
Right. Who we should just reiterate, these were both factions within the conservative movement, and this was a movement that 10, 15 years before didn't even exist. There was this rapid rise of the popular conservative movement, and the Birchers, although they were completely insane, were one of the fastest growing parts of that movement.
And Buckley and the Birchers had a lot of common ground and worked together on a lot of these things. There was a meeting that took place with Barry Goldwater and Buckley and others about what to do about this whole Birchers thing and the fact that they're running around saying that Eisenhower is a communist. And Goldwater explained the reason that he couldn't completely denounce them. He said, "Every other person in Phoenix is a member of the John Birch Society. I'm not talking about commie-haunted apple pickers or cactus drunks. I'm talking about the highest caste of men of affairs." Essentially, that is the grassroots conservative movement is made up of these people. He can't get away from them.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a really good parallel in modern politics. The fact that QAnon, which in many ways is the modern manifestation of the John Birch movement, is totally bonkers, but it's also pretty popular in a lot of right-wing areas, which means that...
You can't fully denounce it.
Which means that although only a couple elected officials have supported QAnon, and even then they've had to kind of step away from it, very few politicians have openly, on the right, have openly denounced QAnon. Because they know that if they say QAnon is false, that we do not believe that Joe Biden is a cannibal, then they know that a lot of their voters are going to turn against them.
Exactly, and that's the same tightrope that Buckley talked about walking. In the end, Goldwater... At first, they tried the strategy of separating the leader from the organization and distancing himself from what Welch said.
Oh, so they would say it's not the whole Birch Society, it's just Robert Welch. He's the problem.
That was what they tried for a bit. But in the end, it didn't really work out because, as said previously, this was a dictatorship. The Birch Society's ideology was just what Welch believed. And this is from the National Review in 2017. So, of the various projects that the JBS took on, its campaign to impeach Chief Justice Earl Warren drew the most attention from the mainstream media. And the cases that he pointed to in his evidence that Earl Warren, who, by the way, was a Republican, and appointed by a Republican, Eisenhower, their evidence that he was a communist was a few decisions, most notably the striking down of loyalty oaths, the extension of the First Amendment protections to communists, ban of school prayers, imposition of one man, one vote, and legislative appointment. But above all, its overturning of the separate but equal doctrine, which put the nation on a path to desegregation. National Review had editorialized against all the Supreme Court decisions to which Welch objected. That is from their own piece. It's like, yeah, we agree on all this. We agree that that overturning separate but equal is wrong. And that right there is where it all becomes very, very blatant. Getting rid of separate but equal, this is what really animated a lot of these people.
Oh, so even today, so you're saying even today they say they oppose desegregation?
They put it in more lofty terms, but the article...
Oh, holy shit. Even today, I'm surprised that anyone today is saying that, even like, except like explicit white nationalists.
National Review had editorialized against all the Supreme Court decisions to which Welch objected. It favored reversing them through congressional action, appointment of rightward-leaning justices, and, where necessary, constitutional amendment. But as a result of Buckley's opposition to the Impeach Earl Warren campaign, the National Review received numerous complaints by mail, many of them Birch-generated. And then it goes on to talk, this article goes on to talk about how these people were emailing him stuff that just said, "You are a communist, you should die," calling him Judas, all this insane shit. But they really, yeah, these people were, Buckley was openly supportive of apartheid South Africa. These were evil people. But as the John Birch Society increased its influence, especially within the conservative circles, Buckley tried to remain in Welch's good graces. His reasons were he and the JBS had a lot of common subscribers, donors, and writers, which they admitted.
The conservative movement was so new, and it was still getting its footing, so they were worried that they couldn't afford to cut off their most lively and fastest growing segment.
Yeah.
Welch made no attempt to, you know, run this group with any kind of real professionalism.
Yeah, so Welch had sort of taken on the principles of democratic centralism, except it was undemocratic centralism, where basically he was just given the orders from top down and all of these cells would follow his commands. So he decreed that the John Birch Society would be autocratic in its governance. Any other organizational method, he insisted, would leave the society open to infiltration, distortion, and disruption. He proclaimed the very word democracy is, quote, a deceptive phrase, a weapon of demagoguery, and a perennial fraud. The John Birch Society would consist of clusters of chapters, each with about 20 carefully screened members. He set a goal of building a million-member force. Estimates of how many people actually became Birchers range from 20,000 to 100,000.
Even still, though, even if it's not a million people, 100,000 is still a pretty terrifying number of people to be believing that, like, you know, African cannibals are about to invade the U.S.
Yeah, and of course, these aren't just random people posting on Facebook or whatever. This is an organized political organization.
And a lot of these people are important. They're like factory owners and business owners. And
Yeah. And politically, these guys took over a lot of kind of local positions. A lot of school boards were basically taken over by John Birch Society people. Orange County, California, which has always been a pretty right-wing area, was one of the biggest bastions for the John Birch Society. And there, all of the school districts were totally taken over pretty much by Birchers. And they changed the school doctrines to be explicitly anti-communist across the country in a lot of different school boards.
Truly insane.
Yeah. Going back to Welch's own kind of autocratic behavior, that was really what did it for Buckley, the other leader of the kind of the conservative movement, who in his magazine, The National Review, pens an editorial called The Uproar. What he really tried to do here was he criticized the John Birch Society while being very careful as to not offend the many Birchers that also read his magazine. So he tried to say all his problems were about Robert Welch himself. In a February 13th, 1962 editorial headlined The Question of Robert Welch, Buckley noted that many prominent conservatives had begun to doubt Welch's utility in the struggle against communism. Buckley reported that Goldwater thought Welch should resign as leader of the John Birch Society, and that if he refused, the organization should dissolve and instead regroup under different leadership. Which is a pretty serious condemnation. Like, even though he's not saying, I oppose the views of this group, he's basically saying that it should no longer exist.
So Buckley then started corresponding with a new acquaintance he made and asked for help in this battle against Bircher. Dear Mr. Reagan, Buckley began, well, we have battened down our hatches and it's going to be hell. But as someone said, the right thing remains the right thing to do. Would you let us have a short comment for publication in National Review's next issue? I'd greatly appreciate it. Reagan complied in the form of a letter to the editor in a subsequent issue.
It's pretty funny, yeah. So it shows, yeah, it's kind of like a little bit of foreshadowing there from where the conservative movement would go next.
Yes, indeed.
Well, I guess, you know, and that brings us to a good point. So basically, the John Birch Society didn't really last that long. It still exists, but it wasn't really a broad movement past the early mid-60s. Really, the Vietnam War seems to have taken a lot of the wind out of the sails of the movement. But it seems pretty clear that the general thrust of the Birchers, in a lot of ways, remained part of the broader conservative platform, which became synonymous with the platform of the Republican Party.
Yeah, it's just totally mainstream Republican stuff by now. Just like go back to what the Tea Party folks were writing a decade ago, and it would correspond pretty closely what they had to say about Obama and, you know, what Robert Welch had to say about Eisenhower.
Yeah. Speaking of Obama, the Tea Party had a lot in common, I would say, with the John Birch Society, and it's probably no coincidence that the Koch brothers, whose father was a big backer of Robert Welch, were instrumental in the rise of the Tea Party.
Absolutely.
It's a bit clearly there just is this really strong legacy in the United States of this kind of, you know, anti-communist paranoia. And even though today in the United States there's not a serious, you know, communist opposition, although there probably should be, that same kind of paranoid anti-communism exists all throughout our politics. And this a lot of this kind of Birchy style stuff today is pretty mainstream. Like a very large percent of Republicans believe that Joe Biden stole the election. And most of the ones that believe he stole the election believe that he was doing it on behalf of China. So there's still this kind of weird international anti-communism that's part of it. And I know one thing that you found, Russian Sam, that brings us back to the movie 7 Days of May, is that there were even some concerns or hopes on the part of the right that the U.S. military would intervene to keep Trump president.
Yeah, in summer of last year, this is an article from CNN titled "Top U.S. General Tells Congress the Military Won't Play a Role in 2020 Election." America's most senior general, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, told members of Congress that the military will not play a role in November's election and won't help settle any disputes if the results are contested. Quote, "The Constitution and laws of the United States and the states establish procedures for carrying out elections and for resolving disputes over the outcome of elections. I do not see this U.S. military as part of this process," Milley said in a letter released on Friday responding to questions from two members of the House Armed Services Committee. "U.S. courts and U.S. Congress are required to resolve any dispute, not the U.S. military," Milley added. "I believe deeply in the principle of an apolitical U.S. military."
Yeah, so it seems like the military did not really gesture that they would get involved, but it seems like there definitely are a lot of people who would want that to happen. Even as you pointed out, not just Trump, but also Biden, you said, brought up the possibility of the military stopping Trump from remaining in office.
Yeah, the idea of having the military get involved in the event that President Donald Trump refuses to vacate the office of the presidency after losing the election was floated by Joe Biden during a June interview on The Daily Show. "I promise you, I'm absolutely convinced they will escort him from the White House with great dispatch," Biden said, referring to the U.S. military's Joint Chiefs of Staff. Trump has at times refused to say publicly if he will accept the election's outcome, telling Fox News in July, "I have to see. Look, I have to see. I'm not going to say yes. I'm not going to say no. And I didn't last time either." If Donald Trump refuses to leave office at the expiration of the constitutional term, the United States military must remove him by force, and you must give that order, the two retired lieutenant colonels said in a message to America's top military officer. "We have a constitution, and our constitution, which all members of the military have sworn an oath to, provides no role for the United States military as an arbiter of political or election disputes," Chief Pentagon spokesman Jonathan Hoffman said at a news conference earlier this month.
You know, I think another thing that happened in the last election, which reminds us of this film, is that if you guys remember this, a group of former officers actually penned a letter supporting Trump, saying that they believe that Trump was the rightful winner. Basically, you know, supporting the kind of stop the steal conspiracy theory. And these guys that called themselves Flag Officers for America, they insisted that that Trump should stay in office regardless of what the election results were, which I think also kind of, you know, reminds you of this guy, General Scott, in the movie, this right-wing officer going against the democratic process. Do you guys also, another issue I think we should maybe bring up, do you guys remember in Spain that thing that happened very recently with those military officers?
That was France. You're thinking of France.
No, in Spain. Well, tell me about the French one first, then I'll bring up the Spanish letter.
There were a bunch of generals a couple weeks or I think months back who signed this letter about the threat of radical Islamism as they saw it against France, and how something needed to be done about that. Macron, I think, I don't know if he ended up firing some of the guys who did that, but it was a big, big deal, especially considering France has had military coups.
Well, yeah, and then speaking of, you know, in December of 2020, the exact same thing happened in Spain, where 271 former officers who were retired penned a letter sounding the alarm bells about the fact that socialists and social democrats, you know, had gotten elected into office in Spain. And they insisted that maybe we should go back to Franco. Maybe it's time to use military force again to overturn the democratic process to stop these socialists from coming to power. And what was especially ominous about this letter, it was released on Spain's Constitution Day, which marks the end of Francoist rule. So it seems like a pretty auspicious time to send a letter basically saying, all these foreign military officers wish the military would return to power in this country.
Yeah, so going back to the United States, of course, this letter in question is nowhere near as ominous as the French or the Spanish examples, but nevertheless, this seems very unprecedented. It seems like we're crossing into new territory where the military has to explicitly say that they're not getting involved in political conflicts. And at a certain point, you have to wonder, what happens when the military brass decide that they are no longer loyal to the idea of separation of the military from the civilian government and the subordination to it? What happens when they decide that we are the guys to, quote-unquote, fix the situation?
Yeah, the military has a higher approval rating than any other branch of the American government.
Yeah, they're really the only institution that's widely trusted in this country by people all over the political spectrum. Especially with COVID, basically, when every other private and public sector institution has pretty much collapsed. You know, I could see a lot of people looking towards the military. And of course, you know, now that the U.S. military has pretty clearly failed in Afghanistan, both on the mainstream left and on the mainstream right, you are seeing a lot of pundits argue that actually the Biden administration has failed the military by not letting the military remain in Afghanistan forever.
I mean, shit, with COVID, the National Guard were doing a lot of vaccinations and stuff.
Well, all this goes to show is that, like you said, Russian Sam, it's totally possible that the U.S. military will take a more active role in our politics in the future. It's very possible that the scenario described in 7 Days of May could eventually come to pass in this country. Because even though the American empire seems to be declining in a lot of ways, the U.S. military is still an incredibly strong force in terms of its, you know, ability to project power over other governments. And should they decide to project power over the American government, I don't know who would be able to stop them.
And let's keep in mind that Western Rome continued to exist for 400 years after Caesar demolished the Republic.
Yep, I think that's a good place to end this.
Yeah, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed your time. Good night.